This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we interview the great Washington, D.C. journalist Andrew Coburn about the summer's blockbuster movie Oppenheimer.
Andrew Coburn has investigated the hidden history of why the bomb was dropped and what it did to people, and why that history has never been revealed.
We'll also speak today with U.S. Army Colonel retired Anne Wright, one of the world's great peace activists, about the U.S. posture vis-a-vis China, Korean War, which has never officially ended, and other questions of peace in that region of the world.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm Maria Hall, Los Angeles civil rights lawyer.
And I'm Jim Lafferty, a decades-long political activist and once the national director of the National Lawyers Guild.
The atomic bomb was developed by physicist J. Robert Oppenheimer and his team in Los Alamos, New Mexico. It was dropped unnecessarily on the two Japanese cities of Hiroshima and Nagasaki on August 6th and August 8th, 1945. It was a war crime. The summer blockbuster biopic Oppenheimer does not tell this truth to the tens of thousands of people who have gone to see the movie. Historians have established that it was not necessary to stop the war because the Japanese were ready to surrender. Therefore, the justification that it saved American lives because the troops would not have to fight on the Japanese mainland is false. These two premises, that the bomb was necessary and that it saved lives, are lies, obscured then and carry forward until today. The Cold War against Russia started on August 6th and August 8th, 1945, when the U.S. dropped the nuclear bombs on the two Japanese cities to scare the Russians. The movie does not show the effects of the bombs. Between 200,000 and 300,000 elders, children, and women were instantly incinerated. Hundreds of thousands got sick and died from radiation poisoning. Oppenheimer was a great physicist and a humanist. Although not a member of the Communist Party, he was a sympathizer because of its anti-fascism, anti-racism, and union building. He had second thoughts about his role in developing the bomb and told President Truman in a meeting at the White House that he felt like he had blood on his hands and that in the future, nuclear weapons should be placed under international controls. Truman threw him out of his office, calling him a crybaby. Because of his association with the Communist Party, Oppenheimer was red-baited, denied a security clearance, and ruined. He died at age 62, a broken man. The danger of red-baiting in our country is now quite high. Trump is running on a platform that calls for American-born socialists to be deported. The U.S. Congress, with the support of many Democrats, overwhelmingly voted for a resolution denouncing what it referred to as the horrors of socialism. Recently, in a full-page attack piece in the New York Times, the peace organization Code Pink and one of its financial backers were singled out because of their support for the gains of the Chinese people and their government for improving their way of life. We speak today with Washington, D.C.-based journalist and author Andrew Coburn about the film Oppenheimer and the history behind it. Andrew Coburn, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Hey, great to be with you.
Andrew, the big lie prevalent to this day, and starting back in August of 1945 when the atomic bombs were dropped on the two Japanese cities of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, is that it was necessary to save American lives so that an American invasion of Japan to force them to surrender was not necessary. Please talk about this. You interviewed people in the intelligence community and also the great historian Gar Alperowitz.
Right. Well, the notion that it was absolute, you know, this was the only thing that could have ended the war, that could have caused the Japanese to surrender, and that did make the Japanese surrender, that was really constructed. It was a propaganda line that evolved after the war because, you know, people were starting to get the idea that dropping the nuclear weapons on these two cities had not been such a great idea. So they put out this line saying, oh, well, the Japanese were going to go and fighting forever, and there would have been a million American casualties because we'd have had to invade, and therefore this ended the war and saved lives. So that was the line that they put out, really, with an article in Harper's Magazine to begin with. And, you know, we've been stuck with that ever since. That's really not valid. To start with, as you mentioned, you know, the American U.S. intelligence, and I talked to many veterans of that, of the particular outfit, there was a secret group inside the U.S. military intelligence who had the sole right to listen to and analyze or to read and analyze the decrypted Japanese communications. They were called Special Branch. And they were feeding that to the civilian leadership and the military leadership in the U.S. So they knew perfectly well that the Japanese were getting ready to surrender. I mean, it was, you know, they were reading all the communications. So that when they had this group heard that the bomber dropped, as they told me, they were completely shocked. They said, why did we do that? They were, you know, they were caving in anyway. No, it's not just them. I mean, every other military leader in the U.S. pretty much unanimous in stating afterwards that it was, dropping the bombs was not necessary. Eisenhower said it. Curtis LeMay, who was in charge of the air war in, against Japan, said it. The Navy said it. You know, it was across the board. They said, you know, we really didn't need to do this, but we did.
And Andrew Coburn, what was the justification for dropping a second bomb on Nagasaki 2 days after the bombing of Hiroshima?
Well, they've never really come up with a convincing answer to that one, except that they had it. I mean, they only had two bombs at that point. And this was a different design. The first bomb was a uranium bomb using uranium U-235. And the second bomb was a plutonium implosion bomb. So they'd like, you know, want to try that one out too. And they'd gone to a great deal of trouble and expense to make it. So they really want to try it out. They wanted to see, you know, different. The topography of Nagasaki was different. Actually, Nagasaki was not meant to be the target that day. There was another city, Nakura, they were going to bomb. But the plane got there late and they couldn't see it. The city was obscured by clouds. Lucky for the city, they were diverted to Nagasaki and dropped the bomb there. They really did it. There was no question of not dropping it. They had the bomb. They were going to use it. So, so another, you know, 100,000 people died.
What actually happened to the people living in Hiroshima and Nagasaki? What did the two nuclear bombs do to them? The movie doesn't do much in the way of highlighting that, does it?
No, not really, not at all. You know, you have a shot in the movie in Oppenheimer of there a scene where Oppenheimer is sort of watching the movie, but you're watching a film of Hiroshima, but you don't actually see what he's seeing. You're just looking at his reaction. So no, it really downplayed that. I mean, what happened was, I mean, first of all, there was a sort of, you know, a tremendous fireball and blast, which, you know, incinerated many, many people, destroyed, you know, wooden structures, destroyed, basically obliterated Hiroshima because that bomb landed more or less in the center of the city. Nagasaki bomb was kind of off target and landed, Nagasaki, the topography is sort of divided up by hills and it landed more or less in a sort of valley. So it's the damage in Nagasaki was more limited. But in both cases, tens of thousands of people were incinerated immediately, both by the fireball and by the blast. But more insidiously, there was a phenomenon of the radiation sickness, which they hadn't really thought much about before, which was people who survived the blast suddenly days and weeks and sometimes even years later got sick. And basically sort of, you know, their flesh rotted away. And this was, you know, in a way, even more sort of horrifying death. You know, when that began to appear, people were kind of mystified. And the U.S. military authorities who knew what was happening, they went to great lengths to cover that up. They, you know, they censored stories. The New York Times had initially published a story about radiation sickness. Actually, then, being the New York Times, sort of retracted that, and a week later said, oh, there was no radiation, no such thing as radiation sickness. You know, it was the sort of ghastly, I wouldn't say unintended effect, or certainly initially ignored effect of the nuclear weapons was this. I've talked to one survivor, there are not very few left, a survivor I talked to who, you know, described, you know, the incredible flash. He was actually on his bicycle on the outskirts of the city at the time of Hiroshima. He was knocked off his bike, but survived. Actually, when I met him, he was a still pretty healthy 94-year-old, so there's no accounting for the effects of people. But, well, for a lot of people, it was instant death, and for maybe even more unlucky number, it was a slow and relatively slow and lingering death.
We're speaking with Andrew Coburn about the Oppenheimer movie. This is Michael Smith, and I'm with my co-host, attorney Maria Hall. Andrew, many of us believe, and I've read Gar Alperowitz's book, that the reason that the bomb was dropped was to scare the Russians, that it was actually the first shot in the Cold War. Is that your opinion?
Yes. Well, in a way, let me give a two-part answer. One is, I don't think there was ever any sort of feeling of not dropping the bomb. You know, someone's just published a book, Evan Thomas has just published a book called The Agonizing Decision to Drop the Bomb. I don't think anyone agonized it for like 5 seconds, any of the decision makers. They had the bomb. As I said, they went to gone to a great deal of trouble and expense to build it. They were going to use it, and they wanted to see how, you know, the effect it had. But the prime political purpose of dropping the bomb, and military purpose, was to scare, as you say, scare the Russians. In fact, Groves admitted that before the war, before the bombing, he admitted that to some of the Manhattan Project scientists. Joseph Rotblat, one of them, actually tells this story. And that was the whole point. You know, they had this incredible weapon, and they were just going to use it and kill a bunch of people and say to the Russians, so they could say to Joseph Stalin, hey, see what we can do to you. So that was the main purpose of it. So it was the first opening blast of the Cold War, if you like. Leslie Groves was the American general who was in charge of the whole project to build the bomb, of the Manhattan Project. He appears in the Oppenheimer movies, played by Matt Damon, very well, I might say. So he was in overall charge, the administrator and very hard-driving guy, and Oppenheimer himself was the civilian scientist who was in charge of the whole scientific effort and, you know, that side of things. So that's who they were.
Andrew Coburn, what did Eisenhower, the Supreme Allied General, and the major military leaders at the time say about the dropping of the bomb, and when did they say it?
Well, Eisenhower was the commander in Europe, and he was a five-star general, almost as senior as you could get. And he said it was, and he was seeing all the intelligence. He said this is completely unnecessary, despite all the lies they told later on. Now, they all knew perfectly well that had not been necessary to blow away two cities, that there was no military reason to do it. But one thing I should add is that they'd gotten very used to destroying cities by that point. You know, in a way, it was not a huge deal for them. I mean, they'd been burning using firebombs, they'd been burning down pretty much every Japanese city. In fact, the reason that Hiroshima and Nagasaki got attacked this way was there were only about three or four Japanese cities that they hadn't burnt to the ground or burnt large parts of the ground. So they were, they'd done in March 1945, they'd done a raid on Tokyo that killed 100,000 people in one night, burnt them to death. So they were, this is a fairly hardened bunch of people for whom killing, an incredible number of civilians didn't really bother them very much.
Yeah, there's a real stench of racism and revenge in this, isn't there?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's often said that they would never have done this on a German city. I guess not, although, you know, they'd been doing it earlier in February that year, 1945, they burnt down the city of Dresden, you know, and killed, God knows, 20, 30, 40,000 people, more actually. Earlier in the war, they'd destroyed the city of Hamburg and killed 40,000 people. Again, you're probably right. I mean, it was a racist thing. The war against Japan was much more of a sort of racist endeavor. In fact, both sides, you know, the Japanese were depicted in American sort of propaganda and newspaper cartoons as evil monkeys. And actually, the Japanese did the same thing about the Americans, one might say. But I think, yeah, I think they might not have used a nuclear bomb on Germany if it had been, you know, if that had been the last, still fighting. It was a very racist, and certainly the war against Japan was very racist.
Do you think the film Oppenheimer will generate public pressure to halt the current $1.6 trillion plus nuclear buildup?
I wish I could say yes, but I don't think so. First of all, the film kind of doesn't make that point. It sort of makes a gesture towards, you know, look what we ended up with, you know, that shot at the end of all the intercontinental nuclear missiles. But it's not intended to mobilize people. It's not made that way. And even if it did, you know, they've come to take nuclear weapons for granted in a sort of horrifying kind of way. You know, back in the Cold War, you know, in the 50s and 60s, people were sort of genuinely sort of terrified all the time of nuclear weapons. And, you know, it was all the school children at that time, you know, you had to do nuclear drills, you know, duck and cover. That's all kind of gone away, partly because, you know, we had a few years of not Cold War, and now we're back in a pretty hot Cold War right now. And also, the military has done quite a deft job of sort of getting us used to the idea that you can have a small nuclear weapon attacked. They've got ones now that, you know, are much smaller than the bomb that destroyed Hiroshima. So it's almost like a conventional weapon. So I think for all those reasons, when people are sort of worried about an apocalyptic event, it's climate change. You know, people say, oh, well, you know, I don't want to have children because of climate change. Secretary of State Blinken, showing what a sort of idiot he is, said the other day that really climate change was just as big was just as terrible as nuclear war. I mean, I really don't agree with that. Nuclear war is, you know, having millions and millions and millions and millions of people killed all at once, and the ones that survive the war, the first attack, will, you know, die of radiation sickness. So I don't think it's much comparison. But that, you know, people maybe can only take one sort of apocalypse at a time. So for all those reasons, I don't think the film, which is a brilliant film, will actually do much to mobilize people.
Yeah, that was my great disappointment when I looked at it. You know, Andrew, the initial impetus for developing the bomb, I mean, Einstein wrote a letter in 1939 when they learned that the Germans had split the atom and the Germans were capable of making an atomic bomb. Einstein wrote a letter to President Roosevelt saying that this is terrible, we should develop a bomb. But then by 1942, the Germans had stopped their project, and the United States learned about this in 1949. But nonetheless, they went forward and developed it. And meanwhile, Leo Szilard, who was one of the scientists on the project, and 70 other Los Alamos scientists addressed a letter to Truman asking Truman not to drop the bomb. And Oppenheimer suppressed that letter. And his position was that the bomb should be dropped to show what a horrible instrument of mass destruction it was, and therefore people would mobilize against it. And I thought that was really a harebrained notion. Your thoughts on that?
Well, I think he was looking for an excuse. He, you know, it was his baby. He built it to see it used. I mean, the person who emerges, and I wish, you know, in a different film, they would have used the figure of a guy called Joseph Rotblat, who was a Polish scientist who, you know, made his way to England and was a brilliant physicist, and he was sent to Los Alamos to work on the bomb, 1944, or the beginning of 1945. No, it was 1944. He went to Oppenheimer and or Groves and said, look, I only agreed to work on this horrible thing because it seemed a chance that the Germans would get it first. And we, you know, we had to beat the Nazis, but it's clear that they're not doing, you know, now we know, you know, it's very obvious they're not going to have it. So I can't see any further justification for it. So I'm out of here. They couldn't stop him. They made him promise not to say why he was quitting. So he went back to England and went back to work, you know, teaching at the University of Liverpool. I mean, if there's a hero in all this thing, it's Joseph Roepler.
Andrew, you wrote an article about the movie Oppenheimer. Where can people get it, and can you give us a synopsis of what you wrote?
Well, sure. I wrote it on my Substack, which is called Spoils of War. I'll give you the full address later. But they prompted by the after watching the movie, and it was, as we were saying, you know, I was kind of really disgusted that the movie, you know, soft-pedaled the whole issue of nuclear weapons and what they do to people, you know, what they do to cities or anywhere else they're dropped. I feel that even before the movie, the whole public perception, public sort of reaction to the threat of nuclear war has been sort of dulled and blunted. I mean, in my article, I mentioned the fact a little while ago there was a meeting of the G7 in Hiroshima. And all the Biden and all his fellow sort of allied leaders all made their way to Hiroshima, and Biden made, you know, a sort of pro forma remarks about nuclear weapons and how it must never happen again. Didn't sound like he spent too much time thinking about it. But what I was very struck by was that in the Washington Post report from the meeting in Hiroshima, they said, oh, Hiroshima and Nagasaki were severely damaged, severely damaged when, you know, by the nuclear bombs in the end of World War II. I thought, crikey, you know, how could, you know, it shows how moronic reporting on this and how dull the sensibility has become when presumably they're literate people, these, I think, I can't remember their names, they had three bylines on the piece. Could, or maybe it was an editor put it in, could describe the destruction of two, you know, fairly large cities and the deaths of, you know, upwards of 200,000 people as, you know, severe damage. I mean, really? And I thought, so I wanted to make the point, first of all, that, you know, that how sort of horrifying this the actual attack had been, but also, not many people know or have ever had the opportunity, as I did, to talk to this key group of American intelligence officers, and they were both civilian and military. They were part of military intelligence, but they were basically they were a bunch of corporate lawyers from Wall Street, funnily enough. But they were very smart people who were recruited into this secret intelligence outfit called Special Branch. And, you know, the code breakers had broken the Japanese codes, including the military and the diplomatic codes. So they were really very well informed about what the Japanese were saying to each other. And the Japanese communications were particularly important between Tokyo and Moscow, because the Japanese were hoping to get the Russians to sort of mediate a ceasefire or mediate a surrender, which the Russians obviously weren't going to do. So anyway, the point is that the American intelligence was very well informed. So I wanted to tell that story in my article about these people and their reaction when they heard that the bomb had been dropped, because they were in a very closely guarded office in the Pentagon. And right next door, they found out later, was another closely guarded office, which was the office of the Manhattan Project, the outfit that actually was built in the bomb. Neither group knew that the other one existed. These were the two biggest secrets of the war, and so they were, you know, kept in bureaucratic isolation from each other. So that, and then I'd interviewed Al Parowitz, you know, a while ago, because I think his book, you know, which came out in 1996, but it has never been superseded as a really definitive account of the decision to drop the bomb. I mean, I would put it this way. I would say the decision not to drop the bomb, because they were always going to do it. It would have been, the big decision would have been not to do it. If you read my piece, Gar goes through, you know, all the reasons he thinks, you know, he thinks the way he does. I mean, the most interesting point, which we raised in the interview, was, did they keep the war going so that they could use the bomb, the U.S.? There is evidence for that they knew back in April that the Japanese would probably surrender if they promised to leave the emperor alone, to leave the Japanese political system with the emperor at the top. But they held off on that because they hadn't finished making the bomb yet, and they wanted to see if it worked. You know, if it hadn't worked, they'd have said, righty-ho, okay, yeah, fine, you can keep the emperor, and, you know, now you'll surrender. Which is actually what happened in the end. I mean, they've been saying, you know, we demand an unconditional surrender from Japan. But in the end, they did give the Japanese, more or less an assurance that, you know, they wouldn't get rid of the emperor, which is all the Japanese were holding out for. But that's the most, in a way, the most horrifying part of the story, that not only did they, you know, casually kill a couple of hundred thousand civilians, but they, by keeping the war going for several months, if this conjecture of Gars's Alperovitz is true, by letting the war go on for several months, you know, they killed a fair number of Americans. I mean, thousands, tens of thousands. You know, the whole invasion of Okinawa, very bloody affair. If that could have been stopped, if that hadn't been necessary, you know, it would have saved a lot of American lives too.
Including my father. My father was wounded in Okinawa. And they did that again in Vietnam, and now they're doing that again in the Ukraine. It seems to be their M.O. Andrew Coburn, unfortunately, we've come to an end of our allotted time. Please tell us briefly how people can stay in touch with your journalism.
Okay, I'll do it quickly. First of all, I have a sort of regular column four times a year in Harper's Magazine, long-form pieces, harpers.org. But I also have a Substack, including where I write about the Hiroshima bomb, and that you can find going to Spoils of War, Spoils of War, all one word, .substack.com.
Thank you very much, Andrew Coburn, for being on Law & Disorder. This has been a terrific interview, and we hope that you'll come back again. You take it easy.
I'd be happy to. I enjoyed it. Thank you so much.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
Today we're going to discuss the increase in anti-China criticism coming out of the Biden administration in the White House and repeated in the corporate media. Of course, anti-China bigotry has existed in this country, well, for at least 150 years, going all the way back to the Chinese Exclusion Act of 1882. And today, many political commentators believe that the driving force behind this growing U.S. action and hostility towards China is being carried out in preparation, well, for war with China. War with China if China cannot otherwise be contained, as it more and more challenges the might and global reach of the United States. Indeed, China is already now the second largest economy in the world, and, well, it's on track to soon overpass that of the United States. And a McCarthy-era red-baiting hit piece on the front page of the New York Times of August 6th against the peace group Code Pink and others is also a part of this growing demonization of China and all who would come to her defense or argue against war. So we're going to ask our guest, is a war with China inevitable? Does not the fact that China, as well as the U.S., are nuclear-weaponized nations make such a war, well, frankly, unthinkable? We will also ask our guest about Korea. Korea, with its claimed right to possess nuclear weapons, has also been the target of administrations from both parties. The Korean War ended in 1953, and yet thousands of U.S. troops are still stationed in South Korea. And of course, there is still no peace treaty, no true formal ending of the war there, so the country remains divided. And those who advocate for peace in Korea are also sharply criticized and red-baited by the U.S. government and in the press. So then we'll ask as well, is a renewed war with Korea also a possibility? Our guest for this topic is Colonel Ann Wright, U.S. Army retired. Colonel Wright is also a retired U.S. State Department official, known for her outspoken opposition to the U.S. war in Iraq. Previously, Ann Wright received the State Department Award for Heroism back in 1997 for helping to evacuate thousands of people during the war in Sierra Leone. Today, Ann Wright travels the world and this country, lecturing and advocating for world peace. Well, Ann Wright, a warm welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you. And I love the name of the show.
I do, too. I do, too. Thank you for that, Ann. Well, Ann, your very wide work for peace encompasses, well, efforts by the United States to prevent a peace agreement between North Korea and South Korea. That war ended in 1953. U.S. still has tens of thousands of U.S. troops there. The Biden administration, at least publicly, seems to now be ignoring North Korea a bit as opposed to Trump. Talk to us about that a bit.
Well, indeed. And in Washington, just a couple of weeks ago, we had a commemoration, a national mobilization on the 70th anniversary of the armistice that ended that Korean War in 1953, as you mentioned. It's not a peace treaty. It's an armistice. And we are of the belief that it should be much stronger than an armistice, that there needs to be an agreement for peace on the Korean Peninsula. I was part of a group that went to North Korea in 2015 with Women Cross the DMZ, 30 women from 15 countries, including two Nobel Peace laureates. And we spoke with women in North Korea, 200 of them, 250 of them, that were in a big conference hall, of course, selected by the government of North Korea. But the comments they had about the continuing effects of the Korean War on the people of North Korea and of South Korea were very poignant. I mean, people in North Korea don't want a war with the U.S. People in South Korea don't want a war with North Korea. It seems like the only people that are is kind of encouraging confrontation is more the United States, because the U.S. makes money out of these confrontations, whether it's the war merchants, the merchants of death, the big corporations that sell huge amounts of weaponry to South Korea, to Japan, to other countries, or it's the very influential pundits that work for all of these think tanks that make their living out of continuing the confrontation. The peace on the Korean Peninsula, they'll be out of a job.
Yes. And the other thing is, of course, the United States constantly, when they were trying to ratchet up their excuse around Korea, well, North Korea is, you know, having nuclear weapons, they shouldn't have them, which has always struck me as being sadly awfully hypocritical, given that we have our nuclear weapons, so does many other nations in the world, and I don't know why we have more of a right to them than North Korea does, but that's certainly something they continually use for that.
It's so stupid because they didn't need to have those. I mean, they would not have had them if the the Bush administration had followed through on what the Clinton administration had started, which was a heavy oil energy source for them. But the Bush administration just cut off all negotiations with them. You know, when Obama came in, there wasn't a lot of effort there either. About the only thing I'll give credit to Trump was that he met with Kim Jong-un three different times. And had there not been, you know, one of these war hawks, John Bolton, that got right in the middle of it, it's quite possible we could have had some sort of an agreement. And during the time that Trump was talking to the North Koreans, they did not test, and they have not tested since, any of their nuclear weapons. They have fired off a lot of missiles. That's for sure. I think everybody's kind of amazed that they've had so many missiles, but they haven't done any testing of their nuclear weapons since that agreement with Trump that the U.S. would stop its military exercises, some of which were called decapitation. Now, if that's not sending a signal to the North Koreans of what the U.S. wants.
Yes. And so just we got to move on to a number of other topics. But before we leave the Korean situation, I assume your position would be then that we ought to be withdrawing our troops. We ought to be helping with making sure that there is a peace treaty between North and South Korea, that there is a final and formal end to the war. And you're saying that would greatly reduce the very fears that the United States uses as an excuse not to do that.
Well, indeed. And in fact, there's an excellent book called Hinge Points, H-I-N-G Points, written by Siegfried Hecker, who is the former head of the Los Alamos nuclear facility for the United States. He has actually been inside some of the nuclear facilities in North Korea. And he writes in this book of all of the places where we could have gone toward peace rather than confrontation. So it's possible. It'll take work. It'll take dedication. But that's what peace is all about. And yes, I think we should be working for peace instead of confrontation.
Indeed. Well, moving on to another problematic situation, of course, in Asia. The United States, my Biden administration, the Congress, and the press, are now demonstrating extreme hostility towards China in their actions and in their announced policies. Remind us of some of these hostile actions and policies that the U.S. government has now put forth with respect to China, which, of course, is now the second largest economy in the world and will probably soon surpass that of the United States, threatens the United States' political hegemony in places in the world that they don't like China doing that in, of course. But talk to us about all of that.
Well, indeed, the United States, since the Obama administration actually had its pivot to Asia. That was when the drawdown on the war with Iraq was happening. And, of course, the U.S. always needs another enemy. So once Iraq was finished, it was time to let's head to the halfway around the world to the Pacific and Asia. And that's when really the sanctions started going on China for intellectual property. You know, and they shouldn't be stealing secrets from us, and we shouldn't be stealing secrets from them either. But then the military side of it, where the U.S. started sending large numbers of U.S. military ships on what they call freedom of navigation exercises, which is to say that all the seas are open to everyone and under the law of the sea treaty, except the U.S. forgot to sign that law of the sea treaty, but they still go ahead and use it, saying, well, this is part of a treaty, international law, and we should be sending lots of ships primarily to just irritate the PRC, because they're sending them right in the front yard of China, and they're sending them specifically, I think, to irritate, to antagonize the Chinese. The Chinese, they've taken some of the islands, some of the atolls in the South China Sea and built military bases on them. They've got runways, they've got docks, they've got all sorts of stuff. So when the U.S. starts ratcheting things up, the Chinese have ratcheted it up too, in contested areas with the Philippines, Vietnam, China, all saying those little islands each belong to each one of us.
Then there's, of course, the small matter of Taiwan.
Yes, and that's the next step. you know, 40 years ago under the Nixon administration, the U.S. said that we agreed with a one China policy, that China is the entity that we will be dealing with. And the U.S. stopped diplomatically recognizing Taiwan, even though the U.S. has its language training center for the State Department for advanced Chinese training is in Taiwan. And also could the huge industrial development of Taiwan, where they are the producers of many of the little computer chips that we need for virtually everything in our lives now. So the economic development of Taiwan has really become quite a thing. The primary country that Taiwan exports to is China, though. And the U.S. and the rest of the world, of course, gets things from Taiwan. The U.S., in ratcheting up this confrontation with China, started sending high-level diplomats. The highest-level diplomats in 40 years went in there 3 years ago. We've been sending U.S. military in, and just a day or so ago announced another $500 million sale of military weapons to Taiwan. Now, every time a U.S. visitor comes to Taiwan, the Chinese, the mainland Chinese, see that as an affront, and they send from their air bases, where they're located right on the edge of China, right across the Taiwan Straits, 100 miles, to right to the edge of the air defense zone of Taiwan. And they've sent something like, 50 jet aircraft at a time sometimes. So the potential for inadvertent mistakes that could trigger more and more responses that would lead to a catastrophe is there. So ratcheting down the tensions is in the best interest of all of us of the world.
Mm-hmm. Well, in fact, that leads to my next question. And I was thinking as you were talking as well that, and we don't have time to go into it at great length today on the show, we've done it on other occasions, the historic connection between Taiwan, of course, and China. I mean, its claim to Taiwan is not a spurious claim by any means. But all of these actions you demonstrate represent an increased growing hostility, which has led a good many political thinkers in the United States, historians and otherwise, to view this as leading perhaps to or inevitably resulting in some form of military conflict between China and the United States. The fact that both are nuclear-armed nations would seem to make such a confrontation militarily unthinkable, but there you are. Are those fears reasonable? Might the U.S. find itself in a direct or proxy war with China? And in the same way, it's now engaged, well, in a proxy war with Russia and Ukraine. Talk to us about that.
Well, I certainly hope not. And we can see that the Biden administration is actually pulling back a bit from the extreme rhetoric. They're sending people to China to actually talk to them rather than yelling at them from Washington. The Secretary of State has now had discussions with their foreign minister. We've had Janet Yellen that's gone to China. We've had John Kerry go. So I think the Biden administration has finally recognized how dangerous this confrontation, even though it's not a military confrontation as such yet, they have seen that this is going in the wrong direction. While there's certainly room to argue with the Chinese about a variety of things, human rights, on economic issues, intellectual property issues, all of this stuff. But to keep going after them, that's leading more to a true military confrontation. I think the Biden administration is backing off that. I certainly hope so. But I think the fact that we're seeing more dialogue and more U.S. officials going to China is a very positive move.
It certainly is. It leaves me, though, still wondering, and I would appreciate your thought on this, the concern about China's growing economic strength, as I said, the adduction probably soon to surpass that of the United States in terms of its where it stands as world's economic powers. its political influence is certainly growing and in Asia and Africa and so forth, and that threatens the interest of the United States. It ought not to, but in a given that you have a capitalist country here, not wanting to see its interest and its hegemony where it has hegemony and its ability to exploit other nations without interference from some competitor, that does press hard on the United States in terms of its policies historically. Does that nevertheless still continue to just concern you?
Well, it does on one level, but, you know, it is a competition. The fact that the Chinese have out-competed the U.S. in so many ways, mainly at the fault of the U.S. I mean, when we decide we're going to cede our industrial base to China and let them make everything that we use, I mean, without the Chinese, we'd probably be naked tomorrow. So, you know, they have provided the world with a lot of very inexpensive goods that have been purchased en masse by the world. They are doing things that the U.S. should have been doing. I mean, you look at China and how it has developed the maritime port system around the world. There are Chinese corporations and the Chinese government that has leases now on many of the major ports in Europe and around the world. Even the Los Angeles port, part of it is leased by China. You see the development, the billions of dollars that they put in their road and belt project, where they are using nonviolent means to influence other countries, and by their building roads and railroads. And in fact, here in Hawaii, we've been building it's supposed to be a high-speed elevated train. It's been trying to be built for like 12 years, and it's now like billions overrun. If we had just hired the Chinese, who now have the greatest network of high-speed bullet trains in the world, this thing would have been done probably in 2 years. But, you know, the Chinese they've got the capability to do so many good things and are doing good things around the world. And I think the U.S. ought to take a lesson from how they're approaching their international relations. Not to say they're perfect, but it's a model we ought to look at.
Well, you know, you raise an interesting point. One of the things, because of some past work in my own life, China, for example, in terms of seafaring and which relates to trade and what have you, China actually has more seafarers, trained seafarers, than, well, any other country in the world. If they wanted to, they could basically take over sea trade, and they have not done that. They have not tried to create a monopoly in that regard. They have, as you just pointed out around what they're doing in countries with the ports, they have proceeded in the same kind of temperate and reasonable way with respect to what they could, what they do with respect to seafaring and what they do not do. And so I think you make a good point in that regard. And that is a model we could follow up as we try to, you know, exert our hegemony on places where we have such influence. Well, I'm talking with Ann Wright. I'm Jim Blafferty. You're listening, of course, to Law and Disorder. And Ann Wright and I are discussing what's going on in Asia. We talked about Korea a bit, and we're talking now about China policy, U.S.-China policy. It has been very hostile at times. There's some evidence maybe it's softening a bit. There's been those who have been fearful of actual military conflict between the two nations. Ann has been discussing her thoughts on that as well. And Ann, I now wanted to pick up another aspect of this. The posture of the United States towards China, be it less or more hostile at any given moment, nevertheless has led to a certain adaptation in the corporate media as to how it approaches these questions as well. In the face of this, I'm thinking of what has happened like to Code Pink and others. Now, Code Pink is a peace organization in which you play a leadership role. And it and others have been, of course, raising alarms about what is going on with the U.S. vis-a-vis China, possibilities of military conflicts and what have you. And as a consequence of that, it would seem, the government and mainstream media have now increased their criticality of the peace movement. Indeed, as I mentioned in my introduction on August 6th, the New York Times, on its front page, no less, carried a lengthy article that can only be called a red-baiting article of Code Pink and others, That is, it tried to link your work, the work of Code Pink and others, to some Machiavellian notion of influence from China because of this opposition to what the U.S. government, I say, is doing vis-a-vis China. So talk to us a bit about this, the red baiting, and how your organization is going to respond to that. Indeed, there's even been a call for some of the heads of Code Pink to be investigated because they're supposedly foreign agents who haven't registered and that kind of nonsense. So talk to us a bit about that and how much that does or does not concern you and what you think should be done about it.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's outrageous. For God's sakes, we've been criticizing, Code Pink has been criticizing Vets for Peace, Peace Action, World Beyond War. We all criticize U.S. government policies on war. For the New York Times to have spent so much time, so much effort in the malicious attack on Code Pink, Jody Evans, and her husband, Roy Singham, because they actually talk about positive things that are coming out of China. In fact, the campaign that Code Pink has on China is called China is Not Our Enemy. I mean, one would think that that would be something everyone could go for, except the U.S. has not said that. In fact, you know, U.S. military folks have specifically said China is our enemy. So when you're actually confronting the U.S. government, it has its ways, and we know from the Central American wars and Vietnam War, U.S. media doesn't have a spine in it when it comes to standing up to telling all sides of stories on war-related things. So Code Pink has been targeted, and Marco Rubio, senator from Florida, has said we all ought to be investigated by Department of Justice as being foreign agents for the government of China. Just a bunch of hogwash. We are not foreign agents of anyone. We are agents of peace, and it's not just China, but the same thing has happened on our work on the peace on the Korean Peninsula. Three articles that have come out about attacking women across the DMZ, Christine Ahn. I was named in one of these articles. So, you know, it's kind of like the CIA and its propaganda arm has said, oh, let's take down a couple of these organizations and we'll get some people to write articles. And, you know, we know the New York Times has written such spurious stuff over the years. I mean, its real own claim to fame is being one of the newspapers that did the Pentagon Papers, but Jesus, for all the stuff they did on the Iraq War and everything else, it's a wonder anybody reads that rag sometimes. And certainly after this thing with Code Pink, it is just wrong. But we all have to watch out for that. I mean, Vets for Peace, that has its own working group on China, it has a working group on Ukraine, a working group on Russia. All of us are talking about how to stop conflict instead of being cheerleaders for it. And, of course, that is not what our government wants. The U.S. government wants us to be cheerleaders for war, and we refuse to do it. Therefore, they're going after us.
And as you may know, and I couldn't help but think of this and mention it is because of the historical point I think it makes, you may know that I had the privilege of playing a national leadership role in the U.S. peace movement during the U.S. Government's war in Vietnam. And there was constant red baiting of the U.S. peace movement then as well. In fact, at one point, I, along with, more than a half a dozen other leaders in the movement, were subpoenaed before what was then named the House Committee on Un-American Activities. And why? Interesting. Because of our supposed obedience to and financial dependency on the former Soviet Union. And therefore, when I read that article in the New York Times and talking about money that was coming to help some of the groups and so forth, that the notion that this must somehow be dirty money and that it must somehow all be run in some kind of Machiavellian or like puppets from China, it was all too reminiscent of that. It's what the U.S. government resorts to when the people begin to get wise to what it's doing and want peace instead of war. Isn't that historically true too, Anne?
Well, indeed it is. And Jim, thank you for what you've done over the many years, beginning with the Vietnam War and bringing back those examples that this is not just a one-off thing. This is a pattern that the U.S. government does. And when you work on issues of China, of North Korea, of Iran, of Cuba, All of these things, the U.S. government wants us to think in one way, and we are saying, now, wait a minute. We've actually been to these countries. We've seen what's going on, and we think the effect of U.S. policies is something we need to push back against. And just for that, then you become a target of the U.S. government.
Yes.
And I fear our time is about up. Can you let our listeners know how they can get in touch with you, find out, go to your webpage, learn more about your speeches, your thoughts, learn more about Code Pink, and if they care to join in this peace effort.
Indeed. Code Pink, womenforpeace.org, and then my website is voicesofconscience.com.
Well, Anne Wright, we thank you so much again for being with us here on Law and Disorder. Thank you so much for your work and for joining us again today.
Thank you, Jim.
And I thank our listeners for joining us here today on Law and Disorder, and I urge you all to visit our website, lawanddisorder.org. There you'll learn ways to support the show and spread the message of the show, and we'll appreciate that as well.